Andy Jassy is sitting at a small desk somewhere in the Amazon headquarters in Seattle in early 2003 with a draft document in front of him, and he is reading it for the 31st time. The document is 6 pages long. It is double-spaced. It is the kind of document Amazon writes instead of presentation slides because Jeff Bezos has decided years ago that the act of writing a real document with real sentences and real paragraphs forces the writer to think in a way that a slide deck does not. Jassy has been Bezos' chief of staff. He has been shadowing him in meetings for several years. He is, at this point, in his mid-30s, and the project he's working on is being treated by almost everyone at Amazon as a curiosity. The project is the proposal that Amazon, an online bookstore that has just begun to sell consumer electronics and clothing, should also start selling computing infrastructure to other businesses. Not the books, the computers themselves. Or, more precisely, access to the computers themselves by the hour, by the gigabyte, by the second paid for with a credit card. The 31st revision is the one that will go to Bezos for approval. Each previous revision has been sent to a small group of senior engineers and executives who have written back, in turn, with objections, with questions, with suggestions for the structure of the argument. Some of the objections are technical. Most of them, in this iteration, are strategic. The strategic question, the one that has not been settled yet, is whether Amazon is a retailer that happens to run a lot of computers, or whether Amazon is, secretly, a computing company that happens to sell books. Jassy is arguing for the second. He believes Amazon's internal engineering teams are spending up to 70% of their time on what he calls, in the document, undifferentiated heavy lifting. Setting up servers. Configuring databases. Allocating storage. Running cables. Patching operating systems. None of that work produces any customer value. None of it makes the books arrive faster or the prices lower. It is the cost of doing business in a world where every company has to build its own computer room. And Jassy's argument, the argument he has rewritten 31 times to get exactly right, is that this work could be done once by Amazon and rented to everybody else. This is Rust, gently. A patient introduction to how computers actually work and to one particular language for talking to them. I am your host. This is episode 16, Cloud as Utility. Today I want to tell you the story of how computing became something you rent by the second from a giant company you have never visited. By the end of this episode, you will understand what people mean when they say the cloud. You will know why almost every company on Earth now runs on it. And you will see how a quiet shift in accounting, capital expenditure becoming operating expenditure, rearranged the economics of starting software business. Let me back up to the years before Jassy's document, because the structural decision that made all of this possible was not the document. It was an earlier memo written by Jeff Bezos, internal to Amazon, with no formal name, but commonly known as the API mandate. The memo went out around 2002. It had 5 rules. The first rule said that every team inside Amazon would, from now on, expose its data and functionality through service interfaces. The second rule said that every team would communicate with every other team only through those interfaces. The third rule said that no other form of communication, no shared databases, no backdoors, no shortcut links, would be allowed. The fourth rule said the interfaces had to be designed to look exactly like external APIs, the kind of thing you would expose to other companies, even when they were only used internally. The fifth rule said that every team had to design their interface from the start to be exposable to outside developers. No exceptions. The memo ended by company legend with the line, "Anyone who does not do this will be fired. Thank you. Have a nice day." The mandate sounded, to people inside Amazon at the time, like an arbitrary engineering tax. Why would the team that does book recommendations need an API that an outside company could in principle call? What is the use case? Bezos did not explain. He just said do it. The engineers complained. They did it anyway. And for several years, every team at Amazon spent a great deal of time rewriting their software to talk to other teams the way two strangers across a network would talk. The work was painful. It was slow. It produced no visible customer value at all. What it produced, invisibly, was the structural foundation of every cloud service Amazon would ever sell. By the time Jassy was writing his 6-page document, Amazon's internal infrastructure was already, accidentally, structured exactly the way an outside business would consume it. Every internal capability, storage, compute, queuing, payments, was already wrapped in an API. To sell that capability to outside customers, all Amazon had to do was open the door. There was no need to rewrite the backend. There was no need to reorganize the engineering teams. The teams were already operating internally, as if they were vendors to one another. Selling that same capability to outside companies was, technically speaking, a matter of changing who was allowed to call which interface. The structural work, the painful 3-year migration the engineers had grumbled about, had already been done. The first door they opened was a service called S3. It launched on March 14, 2006. The name stood for Simple Storage Service. The pitch was simple. You could store any file you wanted on Amazon's infrastructure for 15 cents per gigabyte per month, and you could move it back out for 20 cents per gigabyte, billed by the second. No setup fee, no contract, just a credit card. What that meant for any developer in the world was that the storage problem went away. If you were building a small piece of software at your kitchen table in 2005 and you wanted users to be able to upload photos, you had to buy a server, configure a hard drive, set up backups, decide what would happen when the drive filled up, decide what would happen when the drive failed, write software to handle all of it. By March of 2006, you did not. You used S3. You stored as much as you wanted. You paid a few cents a month. You forgot about it. Within 2 months of launch, the number of objects stored on S3 had exceeded Amazon's internal forecast by a factor of 100. By 2025, that number is over 100 trillion. A few months after S3, on August 25, 2006, Amazon launched EC2. The name stood for Elastic Compute Cloud. The pitch was, again, simple. You could rent a virtual computer by the hour. You did not own it. You did not see it. You did not know which building it lived in. You open a web page, you clicked a few buttons, and a working server appeared, and you could install whatever software you wanted on it. And when you were done, you could turn it off and stop paying. EC2 was built, largely, by a team of engineers in Cape Town, South Africa, led by a man named Chris Pinkham and a colleague named Willem van Biljon. Most of the people I have just named would not be famous by any standard outside their own industry. But what they built changed the shape of how every software business since 2006 has been started. Here is the change in plain terms. Before 2006, if you wanted to start a software company, you needed money. Not a lot of money compared to other businesses, but real money. You needed about $50,000 in physical hardware. You needed a contract with a co-location facility, somewhere you could put your servers with reliable power and a cold room. You needed a network engineer, or you needed to be one. You had to do this before you knew whether anyone wanted your software. The capital was up front. It sat on your balance sheet. It depreciated over years. If you guessed wrong about how popular your software would be, you either had too much hardware, or, more painfully, you ran out of hardware on the day you went viral and your service collapsed under its own success. After 2006, none of that was true. You opened EC2. You spent $20 a month, or if your service became wildly successful, you spent $8,000 a month, and you only paid for the months it was actually big. The capital expense disappeared. It became an operating expense. The shape of starting a company changed. The investors who were watching noticed quickly. A whole generation of software companies, the ones founded between roughly 2007 and 2014, built themselves on Amazon's cloud and a credit card. Dropbox started this way. Airbnb started this way. Stripe, Slack, Pinterest, Hajichi. Instagram, when it was acquired by Facebook in 2012 for $1 billion, had 13 employees, and most of them lived inside Amazon's data centers. Netflix, by 2016, had moved its entire streaming infrastructure to AWS, becoming one of the largest customers Amazon had, and the irony of one company renting space from another to run a video service that competed for the same eyeballs was not lost on anybody in either organization. What the cloud had created was a marketplace where the infrastructure was so cheap and so flexible that even direct competitors could rent it from each other and still come out ahead. In November of 2014, at a conference in Las Vegas called reInvent, Amazon announced one more product called Lambda. Lambda was an even further compression of what it meant to rent a computer. With Lambda, you did not rent a computer. You uploaded a small piece of code called a function, and Amazon would run it whenever something happened that you said should trigger it. You paid, not by the hour, not by the second, but by the millisecond of execution time. You did not see a server. You did not configure a server. There was, from your point of view, no server. The infrastructure had become so abstract that the very idea of a machine had begun to dissolve. As of today, more than 1.5 million developers use Lambda, and they invoke tens of trillions of function calls per month. The cloud, today in 2025, is a $752 billion market. Amazon's slice of it, AWS, brings in about $126 billion in annual revenue. Microsoft's slice, Azure, brings in about $87 billion. Google's slice brings in $28 billion. Between them, those three companies host most of the consumer-facing software anyone listening to this episode has ever used. When you load a web page, when you stream a movie, when you check your bank balance, when you send a text message, in the overwhelming majority of cases, the work is happening on a virtual computer that one of those three companies rents out in a building you will never see, in a city you may not even know. Three things to carry away from today. The first is that the cloud is not a metaphor. There is no cloud. There are large buildings in industrial parks full of computers that are rented out by the hour to anybody with a credit card. The buildings have addresses. They have power bills. They're physical. The word cloud only means that you, as a customer, do not have to think about which building. The second is that the cloud became possible because Jeff Bezos, in 2002, made an unpopular engineering decision that every team at Amazon would talk to every other team through formal interfaces. The decision looked, at the time, like an arbitrary internal hygiene rule. It turned out to be the structural foundation of a $100 billion business. The third is that the shape of starting a software company changed in 2006. The capital costs collapsed. The barrier to entry, which had been about money, became almost entirely about ideas. That is the world you live in now. It is, in some ways, the best moment in human history to start a software company, and the cloud is the reason. Next time on Rust, gently, we will arrive at the present. We will walk into a Toronto bedroom in 2012, where two graduate students and their advisor are training a network on two consumer graphics cards. We will talk about how a piece of hardware originally built to make video games look pretty turned into the engine that powers every modern AI, and we will trace why the infrastructure underneath that AI is being written quietly in a particular programming language we have not yet named directly. Until then, take good care of yourself. I will see you in the next one.